We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. 10 days ago, the world was rocked by terrorist attacks on the United States. And as the days go by, we continue to ask why. This afternoon, in this portion of the program, we look into the psychology of terrorism. Our guest is noted psychiatrist Dr. Robert J. Lifton. Robert Lifton is the author of many books. In light of our discussion today, I'll mention two. Destroying the World to Save It, Om Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence and the New Global Terrorism, and The Protean Self, Human Resilience in an Age of Fragmentation. Dr. Lifton is Distinguished Professor of Psychiatry and Psychology at the Graduate School University Center and Director of the Center on Violence and Human Survival at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. Join us with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Dr. Lifton, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm happy to talk to you.
Your book, Destroying the World to Save It, begins with these words. It is not true that there is nothing new under the sun. To be sure, the oldest human emotions continue to haunt us, but they do so in new settings with new technology, and that changes everything. The terrorist attacks on the U.S. didn't use a new technology, but the setting was new. Would you share your thoughts with us about the impact of this act of terrorism?
Well, as I'm sure you know, the impact has been enormous, and in a way, even the technological instruments were rather new. It's been unusual to hijack an airplane, especially a large passenger liner, jet liner, and render it a battering ram into an enormous building. So in one sense, the terrorists were very low-tech. They just used knives. But in another sense, it was kind of diabolically brilliant and high-tech to the extent of using an airplane in that way. But in terms of the general American response, people have been stunned by the idea that this could be done to our country, and the whole issue of vulnerability, which we have to talk about carefully, is an enormous one. And of course, everything is influenced by what happens to the immediate survivors in the New York area and what steps the country takes in retaliation. All that contributes to or affects our national emotions and feelings.
Yeah. Also, something that strikes me as a little bit different about this as well was the way we saw this happen live in front of us.
Absolutely.
One tower of the World Trade Center was hit. Video crews immediately go to the scene, and capture and broadcast live the second plane crashing through the second tower.
Yes, so it's terrorism, terrorism recorded on television, and we've had suggestions of that with early acts of terrorism, but this was the most enormously destructive act that could be at the same time televised. I do think, so everybody in the country and throughout the world, in a way, becomes something of a survivor of it at whatever remove. But I do think from spending some days in New York that when you're in New York, you feel the act of terror more viscerally because you experience the terrible pain and loss on the part of people who are most affected. And those posters put up everywhere and at particular centers, which just scream out with their loss in their own quiet way, and which have, in a sense, now become accompanied by candles, creating informal acts of worship or of a spiritual response to people we know now are dead. So in New York, you do feel it more directly, but certainly television makes much of it available everywhere.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about the response of New Yorkers to this tragedy? I've been so moved to see the people of New York respond.
Yes, it has been moving. When you're there, you get a sense of community, which hardly exists in New York in that way most of the time, and of people reaching out with warmth for each other and really trying to share in that pain and loss. Unfortunately, and it's very real and very intense, and it really affects you when you're moved by it very much when you're there. Yet one knows that it's in the nature of disasters for this early response of sharing and help and mutual support to give way over time to problems, to various contradictions in people's behavior, or to various forms of antagonism and name-calling, which are almost inevitable in following this early, one might say, honeymoon period. But overall, the people of New York have done extraordinarily well. And I have to say that the tone of Mayor Giuliani, who's been a man of mixed reviews in many ways until this point, but what he's managed to do that's so impressive is to convey to people his sense of deep concern, a sense of leadership, never in any way diminishing the depth of the reverberations of the attack, and on the other hand, conveying a kind of strength that calls for an even-handed response, a kind of reflection and help for each other. It's rather remarkable that a man could emerge with that quality of leadership in so difficult a situation.
I think all of us have been thinking about what it means to be courageous, what the meaning of courage is.
Yes, and I have to say that I can't help contrasting that kind of behavior, at least in its psychological impact, the behavior I've mentioned for Giuliani, which everybody has witnessed, with the behavior of our national leaders, which has been mostly, unfortunately, a kind of drum beating for war, and with war rhetoric, and with the idea of our being in a war central, in a way that I think has lacked that balance that I mentioned in relation to Giuliani, and has perhaps temporarily overcome or temporarily enlisted the anger and rage of Americans, which is very real, and perhaps helped people overcome some of their initial pain and fear, but at the same time has to lead to a lot of confusion about what war means and a new wave of anxiety about that,
yeah.
in a way that seems to be reflected in the stock market.
How do we as a nation respond ethically?
It's a very difficult response, I think. So I would feel, anyhow. One needs a fine line between, on the one hand, a definite confrontation of the terrorists and some way of bringing them to justice. That, I think, as you know, I've said before, the American people really need and deserve that experience of justice in relation to the terrorists. The terrorists did commit an evil act, and it was one of mass murder. That has to be recognized and said. At the same time, that fine line should include restraint in response, avoiding mass bombing or lashing out in various directions where it's uncertain about who one is killing and whether one is anywhere near the actual terrorist leaders who were responsible for September 11th. If one doesn't have that restraint and that discrimination in response, it will intensify the dynamic of terrorism and response and escalate it so that there is the terrorism, which is vastly destructive. There's the response, which becomes warlike or war, perhaps further acts of terrorism or of further retaliation coming from somewhere in the Arab world, and then further acts of on our part, which could be still more violent. In that sense, one is getting into a very nasty dynamic of escalating violence, which wouldn't be beneficial to us or to anyone else, and I do worry about that. And here, there is a question of how one transfers psychological emotions into political policy. The emotions of anger and rage are inevitable and human, and we have to recognize them. But I do think that real leadership would, in some way, try to transform them into restrained and disciplined forms of policy and approach that strike the balance that I mentioned before.
Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Fortunately, I could probably ask at least 10 questions. There's so many different dimensions to look at this from psychologically, but I guess I would, and you already are starting to touch on it, but I'm very interested in the psychology between the terrorist and the U.S. government, and it seems to me that the terrorists are very much wanting to provoke the United States into military action, and that, I think, would do them a lot of good, not only in terms of helping them recruit more people to their cause, but also it seems like talking about this in terms of war gives them an awful lot of power, and you know, I don't know that this is really what Bush wants to do, but it seems like in many ways the way he's talking about it is giving too much to, you know, the people who did this.
Well, I think you're raising an important point, and let me respond a little bit. I think that when you look at the motivations of the terrorists, there are some specifically political motivations. They want to get America out of the Middle East, and they'd like to harm America as much as possible, even bring us to our knees, as the expression goes. But I think there's a further apocalyptic dimension to the terrorism that may not even be clear to the terrorists themselves, and it's really to destroy much of the world in order to remake it along extreme Islamic lines that they may envision. And for that kind of apocalyptic motivation, the more the violence escalates, the more the terrorists achieve their goals, and it would be certainly, as the caller suggested, it would be certainly something they would want to see. It's really an effort to create a back-and-forth kind of violence that results in a kind of Armageddon or some sort of near-world destruction. That's a major reason why restraint is called for, even though one has to seek out the terrorists, but wise restraint and controlled behavior is what's really needed on our part.
Well, another, coming at it from a totally different direction, I know you did research on the victims and survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I realize this isn't on that scale, but I just wonder, you know, from what you learned there, what kinds of things you could say about, you know, the people in New York and Washington, D.C., and their, you know, the kinds of things they're going to have to deal with.
Well, you know, there have been associations to Hiroshima or nuclear weapons that have come from some of the survivors and some of the people observing the disaster in New York. Some people have noted that that enormous cloud of smoke resembled a mushroom cloud, and just the dimensions of thousands of people killed, they nowhere come close to the people killed in Hiroshima, but it's a lot of human beings who are killed in a very extreme, sudden way. That's reminiscent of a large disaster like Hiroshima. Also, people fleeing from the center, and even the term ground zero is essentially an atomic or nuclear term, and that's reminiscent of Hiroshima, and some of them fleeing toward water, toward the Hudson or whatever water they could find, and that also happened in Hiroshima, where rivers run through the city. In terms of the survivors, there are many common responses which I began to try to articulate about Hiroshima that apply to other disasters, particularly large-scale disasters, and they include struggles with numbing and feeling, and certainly we've seen that, sort of swings between really feeling numbed and at times feeling enraged or feeling confused, with considerable death anxiety, the fear of a further disaster, certainly early on in survivors' experience. There also can be feelings of self-condemnation. We haven't heard too much about that, but they have to exist, in which people feel, however irrationally, that they should have done more, that people right next to them should not have died, and why did I survive while others died, or why didn't I do something to save more people, when, of course, there was nothing one could do in actuality. But that kind of self-condemnation undoubtedly exists, as it does in any such disaster. And above all, there is a struggle for meaning. All survivors need some sense. We're meaning-hungry creatures, and survivors of any kind of disaster need some kind of form or meaning structure to take from it. And that isn't given by the disaster itself. One has to create it, or groups of people create it. And that's still a struggle here, because survivors seek that meaning, and then often some kind of survivor mission that has to do with that meaning. Just to give you an example, in Hiroshima, which you asked about, the kind of meaning that many survivors could struggle to take on had to do with conveying to the world what happened in Hiroshima, the first use of an atomic weapon, in a way that might serve the world and prevent any recurrence of the use of such a weapon. And in the Holocaust, some of the Jewish survivors had the idea of creating a Jewish entity, a Jewish state, in Palestine, as a kind of survivor mission for World War II. And, you know, it's worth saying, it's an aside in a way, but part of one way of looking at the terrible struggles in the Middle East is that one has two different survivor groups, each of which has really suffered great loss and great trauma, and there they are confronting each other. But the people who survived the New York disaster are still struggling with meaning, and that's where leaders come in, can have some importance. Certainly there are some who might seek vengeance, though one hears little of that coming from the center of disaster, from New York, and maybe more from people outside of New York. Over time, there's a question of whether one can't derive more even-handed kinds of meaning that have to do with accepting the inevitability of some vulnerability in the world, taking steps to prevent terrorism from succeeding, and finding ways to live in a world and cooperate with others internationally in which one tries to minimize the danger of terror.
Mm. A lot of people have responded by hanging up the flag, waving the flag, donating blood, donating to the Red Cross and other groups. And that's a very understandable way of trying to do something. What else could people do individually and collectively to respond ethically and humanely?
It's difficult for most people to know what to do. Even in New York, there were many people who tried to run to the disaster area, wanted to donate services of some kind, tended to be turned away because people more trained for that kind of work could better do what needed to be done. And for most people throughout the country, it's hard to find a way of helping survivors. Of course, people send in money, and I'm sure that helps and gives one the feeling one is doing something. I think one way that that one can do this is to think through the whole situation, think through the pain of survivors, and reflect on the sources of terrorism. In other words, it's hard for somebody in the Midwest or Far West or anywhere outside of New York City, and for that matter, outside of a small area where the disaster occurred, because the northern part of Manhattan is not much involved in the disaster compared to the southern portion. So it's hard for any people to do much directly, and the best we can do perhaps is to do anything we can to support, you know, aid that's given to these people, and to be in any kind of dialogue that we can be with them, but at the same time to think through the whole disaster. I think it's important for Americans, as survivors by proxy or at one or two removes, to think through causes of this. What is happening in the dynamic of terrorism which we might have contributed to? We have some culpability in the dynamic of terrorism that has to do with things we've done or not done in the Middle East, also with our having trained some of the terrorists who are undoubtedly involved in this in Afghanistan earlier, and with our having engaged in what has been rightly called nuclear terror along with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. So that I think we should think through all these things rather than, and I think individual citizens should think of ways of supporting nuanced policies and wise policies with a minimal use of violence, to do this as a kind of lesson that can be expressed politically and internationally in relation to this kind of survival that we all go through. Mm. And one thing that's been lacking from our leadership has been any kind of examination of the sources of terrorism in which there isn't some absolute good and evil. I fear we fall into the polarization that's obverse of what the terrorists are doing, dividing the world into good and evil. In their case, we're evil, mm-hmm. the great Satans or whatever, and they're performing their actions in the name of a higher good. If we polarize the world and say that anybody who isn't with us is for the terrorists, as our president said last night, I fear that we're doing our own polarization of the world into good and evil rather than looking more sensitively into these areas with the nuances of people's responses and seeking to reach people more constructively in ways that isolate terrorists. I mean, we won't eliminate terrorism. We do have to take steps to combat it, but if we're absolute and polarizing in our approach, we encourage or stimulate people who are wavering to move toward terrorism because they resent that kind of American approach. So these are things that Americans have to be doing as our overall experience of meaning in relation to this event.
Mm. I imagine that you find very troubling the name for the military operation now being launched, Infinite Justice.
Well, it's the infinite that does trouble one.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need justice, and when I've studied survivors of the Holocaust, what they wanted most of all was, it's what I call restoring a moral universe, because they had been involved in the most immoral sort of universe, what I call a counterfeit universe, and part of restoring a moral universe is finding some expression of justice. But when we make a crusade or a project for infinite justice, there is something almost apocalyptic about that, and that worries me. If it were simply Project Justice, I think it would be a little more reassuring. And you know, when you have extreme behavior, it has the tendency, or at least the possibility, of evoking extreme behavior in response to it. And that's what we really need to avoid.
Let's talk with another listener, this one in Chicago on line 4. Good afternoon.
Thank you. I almost hate to interrupt it because your talks are so fulfilling in terms of enriching our concepts on how things are.
Thank you.
And we've viewed things as being so removed from us in this part of the world, even having gone through the First and Second World Wars of Vietnam and Korea. And it's only when things have impacted here in the nature of this event that has occurred. But setting aside the fact that we've had disasters from nature, whether it's an earthquake or hurricanes and other things, that has caused great discomfort and disaster and distress. Yet we can live with natural disasters and say we've got a wonderful life, but when something like this comes along in a wave of an attack upon our concepts of who we are and what we are doing, it makes us think, while we have a wonderful life, what kind of a life are other people living such that they have to react against the life we're living? And apparently that seems to be the message of the aspects of their ideology, philosophy, and religion, such that they have to take this course. We allow dissent and, not dissent, but practice of different diverse religions. Our diversity embraces so many things, and yet those are excluded aspects in their way of life. And so,
well, that's right. And I think that one healthy and useful kind of meaning or survivor mission would be to do the kind of things that you're talking about. Think through what leads people to engage in such extreme behavior, never not forgiving it and not neglecting to bring it to justice, but trying to recognize its source, and also to try to develop some kind of empathy for people in different parts of the world who have suffered, whether from terrorism or from various forms of terrible suffering, starvation, or forms of war and violence. And it does make a difference whether it's a natural disaster. You know, in studying disasters, we differentiate between natural disasters and man-made disasters. A man-made disaster might be one in which some group has happened, and one that I studied neglected to deposit its cold sludge in a safe way and created another artificial disaster. That's man-made. But this is even more than a man-made disaster. It's an attack, a sudden attack, that's completely a surprise to Americans, and it's done by people who wish us ill, who are trying to bring us down. And that's, of course, the most painful kind of experience to go through. But the sort of, and this is in the spirit of what you just said, the sort of anger and rage which is understandable and inevitable that comes from that kind of experience has to be understood as something that can change in the long range and can give way to more discipline and wiser forms of behavior, rather than it being quickly seized upon in expressions of warlike vengeance. So in all these ways, the psychological and the political and the international all interact, and I think we want to be as wise and restrained in our actions as we can be.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I want to thank the listener in Chicago for his call this afternoon. Our guest this afternoon here on the program is Dr. Robert J. Lifton. He is Distinguished Professor of Psychiatry and Psychology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Next, we go to a listener on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon. Is our listener on line one there?
Yes, thank you. I had to put in some more coins. I've really been very edified by what you had to say today. Obviously, you've studied on this quite long. My thoughts and questions were, you know, when we talk about the horrible things that happened in Japan during World War II, we also need to look at the history books prior to Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and we look at the civilians who were innocently killed in London by Hitler's bombers, and I think what I read in history is about 40,000 civilians died in London. And then we also look at the bombings over Berlin. That city was terribly bombed as well. I wanted to ask you to comment on this, because you were talking a little bit about the administration. George Bush has only been in office just a few short months, and obviously people could put blame on the current administration. But if we, in retrospect, if we look at the last 8 years, didn't the prior administration know about this? Obviously, they did, because he, I think at one time or two times, bombed some areas where the terrorists were having camps, but to no effect, obviously. So they didn't finish their job, and maybe even aggravated it more to where the...
Well, you know, when we look at all this, of course you can't blame George Bush or George W. Bush or the present administration for all that's happened. And I think we as a country, including the previous administration, have neglected to take in dangers of terrorism. It's very hard for Americans to have imagery, to have the imagination of terrorists attacking us on our soil, even though we had certain incidents like the earlier World Trade Center bombing in 1993, or the bombing by an American right-wing fanatic in Oklahoma City. Americans find it hard to give up a sense of invulnerability on our own soil, and that has to do with our history and our geography and many things. And for those reasons. George Bush has a particularly demanding task right now, and I would support him in any efforts he might make to really bring genuine statesmanship to this struggle now, without blaming him for the whole event. One can't do that at all. All that I was raising was the need of immediate leadership now, and that falls upon the president more than anybody else, though others in Congress and the Senate are very important in this, too. The need of this leadership to chart a course that's balanced and that diminishes violence in the world, and do that thoughtfully rather than plunging quickly into high violence. And that the task of making these decisions now falls upon George W. Bush very early in his administration, and that's a very demanding and difficult situation for him and for the country.
I want to thank the caller in Champaign for his call this afternoon. We're going to go to another caller now in Champaign County on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. That last question actually provokes this, which is that the conventional definition of terrorism is the attack on civilians for political ends. And I think what you've surveyed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and you can talk about V1s and V2s against London, or firebombing of Tokyo or Dresden, it's all violence against civilians for political ends. There's actually a breakdown between so-called conventional war and terror, and that's sort of the legacy of the 20th century in some way.
Well, that's a very important point, and I agree with you. Another way of putting it is that this act of terrorism is a kind of culmination of late 20th century technological violence, even though it's not completely high tech. It's use of airplanes, and it's a kind of condensation of 20th century violence, and in that violence, with the help of increasing levels of technology, there has almost disappeared the distinction between civilians and combatants as targets. And certainly in World War II, certainly on the part of the Nazis, and then unfortunately on the part of the Allies, that distinction pretty much broke down in the various bombing policies, culminating finally in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So that, yes, we can't say that these things are a direct cause of this act of terrorism, but they certainly are part of a pattern over the course of the 20th century from which this act of terrorism emerges.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We're going to go to another caller now on line 1 in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I would like to tell the visitor that I really appreciate very much his reading our comments when he says that part of our process of healing is to analyze what led to all of this. And part of it actually has to do with the posture of the United States in regards to the other countries. Not lately, not recently, but maybe going back 40, 60 years ago, many of these problems were created during the Cold War, where some of the United States leaders and agencies decided to take upon themselves to change and to establish what kinds of governments and leaderships were good or best for peoples all over in many parts of the world without taking into consideration their own interests and concerns, without fully understanding their cultures and the impact that these decisions were making on those parts of the world. And I guess that's part of what we're seeing now.
I think I can pick up on that because, yes, during the Cold War, both the United States and the Soviet Union saw itself as in some kind of struggle and crusade, which justified whatever one had to do, even if it ignored the needs of particular countries who got caught up in it. And that was incidentally involved in the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and certainly involved in America's role in Vietnam. And in our present behavior in responding to this terrorist act, there is a tendency of that kind. That is, if we break out, if we tell the world everybody, we'll consider anybody against us who's not completely for us in doing what we say has to be done to root out terrorism. If we say that, we're immediately lacking a sensitive take on what people are really feeling in different parts of the world, why they may object to terrorism, but they might have still very great antagonism toward the United States. Somebody was quoted in one of the newspapers in the last couple of days as saying, America is certainly the most revered and the most hated at the same time country in the world, and that could well be true. It doesn't mean that we can overcome all the resentments toward Americans, or toward America, I should say, but it does mean we can overcome some of the hostility that comes from really manipulating people without understanding their needs, and there is the danger of that happening in an expression of violence now from us in the name of tracking down terrorists or punishing countries that we feel were not forthright enough in surrendering terrorists or in giving us help in tracking down terrorists. I think to do that would be an example of what the caller said, of pursuing our own ends without taking stock of what you might say the existential and political and economic state of people in a particular country and other places.
Let's talk with another listener now, and I thank the woman in Urbana for talking with us this afternoon. Next, we go to a caller in Urbana, again, on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I did have a further point, and that is that it is let's not waste time going
through
recriminations or anything. The capitulation, what I'm trying to get at is that it is not a capitulation to the terrorists to say we should reexamine U.S. policy. We should do that for all the other people that have been activists for all these years, you know, around the world, and for our own sense of justice. So you see this rallying around effect that's happening, and if it does not allow us to be introspective at this point, it's very, very dangerous, because as you point out, it's just going to increase the cycle. I have a further point, and then I will let someone else have a chance. You made an equation earlier that the Middle East is sort of the survivors of two terrible, you know, events, sort of, and survivors of the Holocaust. Well, I've been talking to some people just recently about this, and it's actually much more complicated than that. And I think it's an important enough point to raise that, you know, of course, Israel was, after the war, a refuge for many, many survivors of the Holocaust. But they're all, you know, the project before that of the people on the ground was quite different. And what I'm saying is the antecedents of the Likud party are the Irgun and the Stern Gang. And they were fighting the British during the war. And, you know, okay, it's a digression, but I just see this glibly referred to all the time, and it's just much more complicated than that. And I don't, you know, really, you know, ask you to reflect on that necessarily, but I just wanted to tell people that, you know, there it isn't. It's more complex than that, also. And I'll hang up, and perhaps you can treat the first point about how we need to do the changes in our foreign policy for our own sake.
Well,
thank you very much.
Maybe the larger point, and on the larger point, I certainly agree with you. You know, if we can't reflect on our own behavior in the world, and especially in the Middle East, in this case, where much of this terrorism originates, but really throughout the world, then we really won't be learning much from the act, and we will harm ourselves. Even in terms of complete self-interest, we need to reflect, not in any way to justify the terrorists who did perform an evil act, as I've said in my view and in other people's view, but to try to see the sources of terrorism. You know, when I studied Nazi doctors, to try to grasp their mindset, it wasn't in any way to justify what they did, but rather to look at the psychological and historical sources of what they did and the historical and psychological conditions conducive to evil. We want to do that. We want to look at psychological and historical situations in which we are very much involved that may be conducive to evil of the kind that we experience in relation to the terrorists. Mm.
To analyze, to try to understand, is not to justify.
Yes, that's right.
Religion has often been used to justify evil. Some Nazi soldiers wore labels on their sleeves that read, "God is on our side." How is it that we, human beings, are able to turn religion upside down and inside out?
I think that every major religion has in its basic writings, in its original writings, its sacred writings, a double possibility. One is the one that we seek in most cases, which has to do with compassion, support for life, love, and the various creative possibilities of religion and spirituality. And the other, coming from all the same major religions, is almost the opposite. It's focused on dogma and dogmatism, and when it moves into fundamentalism, it can be an activist form of attacking those who don't have the same beliefs. And the fundamentalist expressions of religion, again, in any of the major religions, really create mindsets, or people's way of relating to these religions creates mindsets which are both absolute, which have no tolerance for the nuances and contradictions and uncertainties that exist in our world, but not only absolute ideas, also a kind of plunge into a past of imagined perfect harmony that never was. And so it's past-oriented in terms of a model of perfection, and often aggressive and sometimes violent in seeking it out. That is the source of the apocalyptic side of religion, in which not only there may be not only the dogma and the absolute that I'm mentioning, but also a vision of applying it and applying it violently in the name of destroying most or all of the world, always with a vision of renewal, which can, in the eyes of those who carry out this violence, justify it, because there's a higher purpose of spiritual renewal. And I think religion per se is neither good nor bad. It just depends upon which of these dimensions or directions of religion one embraces.
Yeah, and that, I think, by thinking about what you've just said also, can teach us something about, or says something to us about, how suicide attackers can see themselves as martyrs.
Absolutely. Most religions tend to condemn suicide, but they often have a place for somebody who gives his or her life for a version of that same religion, for it then becomes an immortalizing purpose. And one can argue, theologians might argue, as to whether this is a true version of that religion.
And as you know, many Islamic scholars feel that Islamic fundamentalists are distorting Islamic religion. Certainly, fundamentalists in all religions distort the expressions of love that are in those religions. But the suicide bomber or the suicidal act on behalf of violence and in the name of religion, one must remember, is always immortalizing. So in that sense, we can say, how can a young man, and even some not-so-young men with families, give up their lives, study to be pilots, give up their lives, and kill others in the plane and on the ground so coldly? And the beginning answer has to be that they're doing it, which in their eyes, in a higher spiritual cause for some deep renewal and personal and collective immortalization. They will live eternally in some version of heaven with all the rewards of that ennobling deed. And in that sense, it's not exactly dying, it's achieving immortality.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Lifton, we're out of time. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. I've enjoyed the dialogue.
Dr. Robert J. Lifton has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's Distinguished Professor of Psychiatry and Psychology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. He's the author of many books, including Destroying the World to Save It and The Protean Self, Human Resilience in an Age of Fragmentation. He is also the author of Death in Life, Survivors of Hiroshima.